Welcome to The Economist, the weekly business news magazine from Great Britain on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. During the next hour, you'll hear articles from the August 8th edition of the magazine. On this week's cover, a humanoid robot wearing a blue Mao Zedong-style cap drives a red tractor across a golden plain with an unidentifiable city skyline and verdant hills in the background. The white plastic robot with black joints and a black flat face with blue LED eyes and mouth displays Chinese characters on its chest and is simultaneously taking a selfie with a Chinese-branded cell phone. And the headline to his left reads, "Lessons from Chinese AI." And that, of course, is this week's cover article, Why AI is a Risk for Communist China. It's not as well placed to take advantage of the technology as many think. After that cover leader, we'll read five additional leader articles, including Reopening Hormuz. Gulf states should make a deal with Iran on Hormuz. Bipartisan and wrong. Republicans and Democrats uniting against animal testing are wrong. How to end Sudan's brutal, forgotten conflict? There's a sliver of a chance of a ceasefire. How AI is breaking the British state? Citizens could bring government to a halt. And onward and upward. Governments are making a dangerous bet on the AI boom. After those leader articles, I'll read a selection of topical articles from around the globe. So now let's begin with our cover leader article. Why AI is a risk to Communist China. It is not as well placed to take advantage of the technology as many people think. Just as frontier artificial intelligence models are benchmarks against each other, so AI will itself benchmark the rival political systems of America and China. The technology will test which is better at creating AI tools and diffusing them through the economy. And that will, in turn, depend partly on their very different ideas of how society should be run. Even in a field changing as rapidly as AI, the results of that contest may not become clear for some years. But as we report from inside China, the country is already adopting AI fast, and its government is preparing for the dramatic economic and social change this heralds. As an autocracy, China has some advantages in harnessing the 21st century's most promising technology. It also has plenty of problems. Start with the caliber of China's models. The common perception is that they're cheap and that even the best persistently lag behind America's. In fact, the two countries' AI models are converging. Innovative Chinese models are getting bigger and cleverer. Within the past few weeks, China's labs have released Qwen 3.8 Max and Kimi K3, which almost match the most advanced American AIs, such as Anthropic's Fable 5. Chinese models will be just as likely to break loose from their testbeds as American ones. Although Chinese models are cheaper, American models are often better value. Artificial analysis, an American firm, finds that for most trade-offs between cost and intelligence, an American model outperforms Chinese ones. The convergence is likely to continue. Although China is building only a tenth as much data center capacity as America, that deficit is unlikely to last. As a semi-planned economy, it is good at creating infrastructure. While American opinion turns against data centers, Southeast Asia is hosting huge Chinese facilities. China's open-weight models can run on anyone's servers, meaning that compute is less of a problem than the headline numbers suggest. China also has almost three times as much installed electricity generating capacity as America. and its lead is growing. China is learning to cope with sanctions. It smuggles in cutting-edge NVIDIA chips and rents them in foreign data centers. And Huawei, its best chip designer, is rapidly increasing the output of its inferior chips. Chinese-made lithography tools are now using deep UV light to print chips, though the best technology using extreme UV remains out of reach. Model building is only half the story. To make the economy dynamic, AI must also be deployed, the focus of Chinese AI policy. For as long as China was behind America in model making, leaders saw diffusion as the best way to compete. But they may also believe that, as with other broad technologies such as electricity, adoption brings greater rewards than discovery. China's working age population is due to shrink by 25% by 2050. For machines to replace people requires diffusion too. So far, the use of AI has yet to show up in the economic statistics of either America or China. But change in some industries has already been sweeping. AI-assisted lorries will need 30% fewer drivers, going from one firm's experience as crews slim from two drivers to one and from four to three. AI was used to generate 95% of the 128,000 wildly popular 1 and 2 minute long microdramas released in the first quarter of 2026, replacing many actors and film crews. China is also rapidly increasing the use of robots. In June, leaders told local governments and state-owned enterprises to have 10,000 humanoid robots doing real work by the end of 2026. Morgan Stanley, a bank, expects humanoid scales in China to reach 446,000 by 2030, 9 times this year's total. Workers are being paid to train robots in huge warehouses by repeatedly folding clothes and sorting and stacking objects. China has a lower share of white-collar workers than America, so AI is likely to have the greatest effect in consumer markets and blue-collar work. That could easily lead to discontent. Youth unemployment is already around 15%. And over 300 million people work in the gig economy. Job destruction could be much faster than China's demographic decline. You might think that the Communist Party's grip on power is so strong that it can ignore the blowback. However, dictators fear being brittle. Although Chinese firms want to roll out AI fast, the government will be desperate to avoid instability. That's why AI will be a test of the system, and why China's options are limited. As in America, there is plenty of talk about retraining. However, retraining has a poor record, and even the most successful countries like Denmark and Singapore struggle to equip workers for entirely new careers. There's no reason to think that China will be any more successful, especially as it already has too many graduates. Prominent economists and advisors suggest extending the social contract by, say, taxing AI firms or creating a universal basic income. Their work has appeared in party journals, an official expression of interest. But President Xi Jinping has long been against handouts, saying they can lead to laziness. Political leaders are pressing companies to redeploy staff rather than sack them. They may also ask state-owned companies to mop up surplus labor. Yet, although that is politically possible, it will cancel out some of the benefits of rapid diffusion at a time when domestic growth is already anemic. So the government may improvise, letting AI rip until it's trouble, when it will step in. That's what happened with tutoring and gaming. Industries thrown into confusion overnight when the party decided that they were causing too much harm. Cautious officials recently slowed robotaxi experiments after more than 100 malfunctioned in Wuhan, leaving passengers stranded. However, Stop-start AI may impair the ability to innovate. If so, China's leaders may have to balance the risk of social instability with the risk of falling behind America. AI poses similar challenges to America and China. Both societies will have to reinvent themselves. That is something democracies tend to find easier than dictatorships. That was Why AI is a Risk to Communist China. Next, our second leader article, Reopening Hormuz. Gulf states should make a deal with Iran on Hormuz. How to make Iranian blackmail less painful. The Gulf states are caught in a mess of Donald Trump's making. After more than 5 months of war, the Strait of Hormuz is still mostly closed. A familiar pattern has emerged. When talks between America and Iran failed to yield progress, the two sides returned to fighting. When bombs fail to break the deadlock, negotiations resume. In recent days, Mr. Trump has once again both talked up a deal on Hormuz and threatened to hit Iran really hard. He gave Iran one last chance to reopen the strait once again. Iran, however, still insists on near total control of the waterway. Its exasperated neighbors seem to hold little hope that it will soften its stance or be forced to do so. Even a new regime in Tehran, supposing one sprung up, may well be unwilling to surrender its new prize. Instead, Gulf countries are racing to make the Strait of Hormuz obsolete. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are both building or expanding oil pipelines to bypass the strait. Iraq plans to divert its barrels north. American and Saudi investors are considering a giant refinery outside the strait. Such workarounds will help, but as our Hormuz dependency dashboard shows, this quest for resilience unfortunately has its limits. Pipeline projects are often delayed. Yet even if all the plans were completed on time by 2030, 5 million of the 15 million barrels a day that crossed Hormuz before the war would still have to pass through it. Besides, pipelines can be struck by Iran. Relying on them risks exposing Gulf suppliers to other choke points, not least the Bab el-Mandab, Strait in the Red Sea, where the Houthis, Yemen's Iran-allied rebels, are firing at ships. Like Iran, they have charged ships fees before they may do so again, although they deny this. Don't forget all the commodities besides crude oil. Without Hormuz, Qatar still cannot ship its liquefied natural gas, a fifth of the world's supply. Gulf refineries remain largely cut off. And that's only on the export side, the part of the ledger that most concerns the outside world. From the point of view of the Gulf countries, many of their critical imports, from food to metals, cannot be sent cheaply overland. Pipelines are worth building, but Gulf countries should also spend more on defending themselves and hasten work on other alternatives. All these fixes will take time. For now, the Gulf states need their ships to traverse Hormuz unharmed. America's bombs have not been able to accomplish this. One drone strike is enough to deter most ships and jack up insurance premiums. The only realistic way out is a deal, however unpalatable. Iran wants to manage the strait jointly with Oman, a more pragmatic government. Negotiating an agreement might give Gulf countries a chance to register their red lines and demands. Gulf countries might have no choice but to pay transit fees. Ship owners would probably tolerate them so long as they did not fall foul of sanctions. That means America needs to be on board. Such a settlement would probably be fragile. International law says that maritime trade should be safe and free. A multilateral deal involving China, which has an interest in keeping the strait open and could restrain Iran, would be more durable. but that looks unlikely for now. Nor does Iran yet seem ready to accept a return to the status quo in the Strait. Still, if a deal, however limited and unbalanced, lowers hostilities and buys Gulf countries time to build workarounds and defenses that reduce Iran's leverage, it will be worth having. Iran looks likely to win this battle, but it may yet lose the longer war. That was Reopening Hormuz. Gulf states should make a deal with Iran on Hormuz. And we move on to our third leader article. Bipartisan and wrong. Republicans and Democrats uniting against animal testing are wrong. Experimenting on animals remains essential for human well-being. It should be a relief when America's Democrats or Republicans find common ground. But one emerging area of bipartisanship is disturbing. Members of both parties increasingly oppose scientific research on animals. If they succeed in stopping it, they will prevent America from helping advance the welfare of the most valuable animal of all, humans. Animal welfare may seem a cause for sandal-wearing lefties, but it has long been advocates on the right and far right. MAGA has embraced the crusade. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the health secretary, has vowed to end all animal experimentation. And under him, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is closing its primate laboratory. The Navy has banned funding for scientific research on cats and dogs. The federal government is joined in the cause by plenty of Democrats, whose party otherwise sees itself as differing from Republicans by being committed to enlightened science. In Oregon, Democratic politicians stand with Donald Trump's appointees in trying to curtail research and shrink the monkey colony at America's largest federally funded primate research center. The surge in opposition to testing partly reflects queasiness about the ethics of experimentation on animals, never mind their enormous contribution to human health. It also results from a growing belief in a new generation of technologies that is transforming biomedical science. So-called new approach methods, or NAMs, include organs on a chip, organoids, and artificial intelligence models. In some areas, NAMs are indeed making drug discovery faster and cheaper without using any animals. Liver chips, for example, can use human liver cells on miniature devices to help identify toxic medicines before they ever reach an animal study. Yet, it would be a mistake to think NAMs are anywhere close to rendering animal testing at scale necessary. Replicating small parts of human biology is not the same as reproducing all of it. Consider vaccines. They're among humanity's greatest biomedical achievements, having saved an estimated 154 million lives since 1974. Yet developing a vaccine entails finding and exploiting a complex biological pathway. Scientists have only just managed to mimic the first steps of this investigation on an organ chip. Finding out the rest is still a process that depends on testing in both animal and human subjects. It's the same story with many other life-saving medicines. There's also a practical reason to keep on testing. If America's laboratories are shut down, leadership on biotechnology will pass to China. Its biotech industry is growing rapidly and has recruited leading American scientists who have faced funding cuts, regulatory barriers, and political hostility at home. China is also buying up research monkeys at a staggering rate, raising their price and squeezing Americans' labs' budgets. The ambition of China makes the campaign for animal rights self-defeating. If American labs stop testing, the work will only migrate to a country that has lower animal welfare standards. In the future, NAMs may be able to displace more animal testing as technology advances. In the meantime, animal welfare can be enhanced in labs. America's decades-old primate center should be modernized with bigger, more naturalistic enclosures for monkeys that allow more daylight. Wearable monitoring technologies would reduce the need for handling, lowering the animal's stress, and improving the quality of the data they produce. This, of course, will cost money. All the more reason to keep funding animal research rather than cutting it off. That was Bipartisan and Wrong. Republicans and Democrats uniting against animal testing are wrong. Next, our fourth leader article. How AI is breaking the British state. Equipped with models and agents, citizens could bring government to a halt. The British state is struggling. Railways go unbuilt and potholes unfilled. Welfare bills go up and shoplifters go uncollared. Andy Burnham, the new prime minister, says he can get Whitehall moving. But then again, so did the previous guy. Yet the British state's ability to function is about to get dramatically worse, a warning to rich democracies everywhere. Citizens frustrated by the poor deal they get from the authorities are turning to artificial intelligence to file objections and appeals and claim their dues. The resulting deluge of complaints and demands will overwhelm bureaucracies built for the age of the post and the telephone. Too little's being done to prevent the state from drowning. This inundation has been dubbed agentic flooding, and its tides are lapping at bureaucracies everywhere, from tax appeals to welfare claims to parking tickets. The waters are rising alarmingly fast in Britain. As we report elsewhere this week, while worries about AI dwell on the threats to safety and jobs, the backlog in employment tribunals has quietly risen by 55% in a year, a large part due to AI-fueled claims. Demand for emergency injunctions has surged 100-fold, and the AI tide has only just begun to come in. Britain has long pioneered new political models, from the welfare state in the 1940s to the third way in 1990s. It's also unusually vulnerable to the march of AI-armed citizens because its administrative functions favor the written submissions that AI is so good at drafting. And so the state must now innovate once again. The good news is that some in Mr. Burnham's cabinet grasp the scale of the challenge. Whether they can rise to it will show whether Britain can once again be a model to emulate or a cautionary tale. Amid low growth, an aging population, and rising defense bills, the state is sputtering in many ways, leaving voters convinced that they are getting a raw deal. But those familiar fiscal problems are at least slow-moving and can be forecasted. Agentic flooding is different. It strikes fast and where you least expect. It does not just damage the public finances. It will also clog the cogs that drive the machinery of state. AI is superb at dealing with bureaucracy. It can digest small print, ferret out loopholes, and draft appeal letters in seconds. Autonomous AI agents will accelerate the trend, filing tax complaints with minimal intervention. Unlike humans faced with officialdom, AI agents will never lose their temper or the will to live. Officials complain about AI slop and hallucinations, but as the technology improves, they will face the opposite problem, demands as well-crafted as first-class lawyers. At first sight, this looks like a cracking result for fed-up citizens. No one likes parking tickets. The poor could exercise their lawful rights as successfully as the sharp-elbowed middle classes do today. Yet, It threatens to become a tragedy of the commons. If the state is overwhelmed and cannot function, everyone loses. When 20th century governments created broad rights, they had the noble idea of making citizenship meaningful. The public would be heard in consultations, get information under transparency laws, and win redress for maladministration from a panoply of ombudsmen, tribunals, commissioners, and judges. But these analog systems assumed that few people would have the time or temperament to pursue their rights to the bitter end, and that most of those who did, few would have the money to pay for a lawyer. AI is changing that, in effect making professional standard petitioning quick and costless. Yet, as each petitioner pursues their own interests, the state will buckle. Britain's labor laws are becoming increasingly expansive, a problem in itself, but they will not be much help to aggrieved workers because plaintiffs face a 4-year wait for a tribunal hearing. An onerous planning regime is meant to produce handsome towns. Paralyzed by AI objections, nothing will get built at all. Britons underclaim the benefits to which they're legally entitled by as much as £20 billion. That's $27 billion, or about 0.7% of GDP every year. If everyone gets their dues, the public finances will wilt. The prospect is of a doom loop of complaints and worsening service. More and more people may come to believe that the only way to get a result is to pull strings or cheat. Amid the inevitable anger and discontent, populism will thrive. So politicians need to grapple with the agentic flooding now, before the tide rises further. One step is to stop creating entitlements that are ripe for AI-fueled claims. Britain's Employment Rights Act and Renters' Rights Act open avenues of legal challenge for workers and tenants. Not only are they misguided, but ministers put little thought into how they would burden the courts. Another step is to prune the mass of procedural rights that have accrued over the decades. To make the state less vulnerable requires tightening rules, closing loopholes, and creating disincentives to AI-enabled access. Byzantine, vague appeals systems should give way to simple, precise, and limited ones. Money should go in part to the solution. Britain should charge a fee for freedom of information requests, as other countries do. So could employment tribunals, which should be more able to award costs against opportunistic claims. The most important task is to act faster and more radically on making the state with AI. That means not just spending up the old cycle of applications, decisions, and appeals, but replacing it altogether. The recast state would be floodproof. It would also be more efficient and more responsive to citizens' needs. Politicians promise to be radical, but their solutions are incremental. Rather than just handling citizens' objections, a new AI-driven planning system could decide for itself whether a housing development meets a zoning code. Rather than processing benefit claims, it could devise personalized welfare interventions. Freedom of information requests could give way to transparency on demand. The state risks being swamped by agentic floating. Even if the state's rapid adoption of AI alarms some people, it is essential. That was How AI is Breaking the British State. You're listening to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. If you missed any of this program or any other of our great broadcasts, you can stream it from our website, sunsounds.org, or from our Sun Sounds mobile app, available for both Apple and Android phones. Now, let's go on to our next leader article. How to End Sudan's Brutal Forgotten Conflict. There is a sliver of a chance of a ceasefire. It must be grabbed. It may be impossible to find a single place that sums up the devastation caused by Sudan's civil war, now deep into its fourth year. But as we report after a rare trip to the country, its ruined capital comes close. Before the war erupted in April of 2023, Khartoum was a bustling city of about 7 million people. Today, its center is deserted. Bare husks remain of government buildings. Smart homes and luxury hotels are in ruins. The streets, charred by fighting, are silent. So many bodies have been dumped that human skulls spill out of makeshift mass graves. And still, the killing continues. Khartoum is the scarred heart of one of Africa's worst conflicts this century. War has destroyed swaths of the continent's third-largest country and driven 14 million people from their homes. Hundreds of thousands have probably been killed by fighting, famine, and bursts of genocidal violence. The only recent African war whose horrors are comparable is in the Congo, which may have killed more than 5 million people in the early 2000s. Yet the war in Sudan is even more important geopolitically. As we warned 2 years ago, it's drawn in neighboring countries, helping reignite civil wars in South Sudan and Yemen, and threatening another round of killings in Ethiopia. Outsiders have shown callous indifference to the suffering by paying to keep the fighting going or neglecting it. Yet by endangering shipping in the Red Sea, the wars in Sudan and Iran are overlapping. That may raise the cost of prosecuting the war to its sponsors, giving them a reason at last to seek to bring about peace. In the face of it, Sudan's war is a conflict between two main belligerents: the Sudanese Armed Forces, the SAF, and the country's regular army and de facto government, and the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, a rich and well-equipped militia. Various other Sudanese groups are allied with the two sides. Yet the fighting is also a proxy war between deep-pocketed regional powers vying for resources and influence. The RSF receives weapons, money, and mercenaries from the United Arab Emirates, though the UAE strenuously denies providing it with support. To a lesser degree, the SAF is armed and bankrolled by Egypt, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. Until very recently, all those actors had an overwhelming interest in keeping the war going. The RSF has periodically claimed to be ready for ceasefire talks, but has used its spoils to grow into a military and economic empire with ambitions to rule the country. And our conversations with SAF leaders in Sudan give every impression that they continue to believe they can vanquish the RSF and hence oppose talks. Meanwhile, outsiders with the power to exert pressure on the belligerents and their supporters have been distracted. Europe is focused on Ukraine. President Donald Trump, who last November vowed to end the war, is caught up in his own disastrous campaign in Iran. Many Sudanese, resigned to being treated as a lost cause, have begun to speak of a Somalia timeline, a decades-long conflict with no end in sight. Now, two developments have combined to create a chance of ending the war, albeit a slim one. Since America attacked the Islamic Republic in February, chaos in the Gulf has mostly made Sudan an even lower priority than usual. Having a shared foe in Iran did little to dampen the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and the UAE that's playing out in Sudan. But as Dwight Eisenhower, a former American president, supposedly once said, when a problem cannot be solved, enlarge it. As the Iran war expands, attention is moving from the Strait of Hormuz, which remains closed for the moment, to the Red Sea, which may be soon. In recent weeks, the Houthis, an Iran-backed militia in Yemen, have launched attacks on oil tankers linked to Saudi Arabia, leading to a sharp reduction in shipping through the seas Bab el-Mandab Strait. So far, Saudi Arabia and the UAE have treated their contest in the region as zero sum. Yet recent attacks in the Red Sea have further underlined the importance of Sudan's coastline for Saudi Arabia, reviving its interest in the war. That could make it costlier and riskier for the UAE to keep up its backing for the RSF, which could open the door to a truce in Sudan, being part of a wider settlement in the Middle East. The second factor is a turn in fortunes on the battlefield. In the past 2 weeks, the SAF has made its most telling breakthroughs since its return to Khartoum 18 months ago. In late July, it regained control of a key highway connecting the capital to El Obeid, a strategic regional hub which the RSF has been trying to capture for months. It has also retaken Kurmuk, a town on the border with Ethiopia. Although now it may be tempted to double down on trying to defeat the RSF, the Arts Army has also long argued that it wants to negotiate from strength, a position it now holds. Moreover, the longer the search for a ceasefire is delayed, the less likely it will be to stick. The two sides comprise dozens of militias. The SAF knows that as the war drags on, more power will drain away to groups with a stake in perpetuating the war economy. Fragmentation will follow, whoever is in charge. True, the chances of a successful ceasefire are small, but the time for a diplomatic push is now. For the next month or so, Sudan's rainy season means that there will be a lull in the fighting. A humanitarian truce proposed by Massad Boulos, Mr. Trump's overstretched African envoy, has a better chance of holding while the battle lines are relatively static. America and Europe should lean on their Gulf allies to press the belligerents to support talks directly to each other for the first time. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Turkey should urge the SAF to stop insisting the RSF disarm and demobilize before negotiations can begin. The UAE should use its influence over the RSF to hold it to its professed desire for a ceasefire, even if that means abandoning the ambition to rule all of Sudan. Somali-style trajectory towards further fragmentation will perpetuate the suffering and instability the war is causing. This is the last best chance to prevent it. That was How to End Sudan's Brutal Forgotten Conflict. Now, our final leader article of the week, Onwards and Upwards. Governments are making a dangerous bet on the AI boom. To see why, look to the bond markets. After a steady upward climb this year, 30-year bonds in America, France, Japan, and Britain are all near their highest since the global financial crisis of 2007-2009. That feat is particularly impressive for Britain, where the highs during the fiscal panic in 2022 have been long surpassed. For anyone who was wondering if yields would return to the lows of the 2010s as inflation fell after the pandemic, markets appear to have supplied a decisive answer. They will not. If anything, they're likely to climb still higher. The culprits are clear. Inflation has not quite been beaten, deterring central banks from cutting interest rates. Even Japan is leaving behind its loose money policies, though not enough to strengthen the yen, which both Japan and America have propped up with official purchases. Gaping rich world budget deficits show little sign of narrowing meaningfully, raising the possibility that governments eventually force central banks to inflate their debts away. Geopolitical ructions like the Iran war and tariffs are lifting the compensation for risk that investors demand. It does not help that Kevin Warsh, the new Federal Reserve chair, fumbled an early encounter with the markets. High bond yields are a problem for indebted governments. Every percentage point rise in America's bond yields, for instance, costs its extra interest payments worth 1.3% of annual GDP within a decade. Yet it's getting harder to imagine governments making cuts to offset the squeeze. In America, each political party seems to be hoping that any debt crisis lands on the other. France's presidential election next year could become a fight between populist parties on the left and right. Japan is, bizarrely, undertaking a fiscal stimulus. The longer governments wait to adjust, the bigger the adjustments become. Governments look increasingly as if they're betting on economic growth to pay the bills, which today means a bet on AI. The trouble is that faster growth by boosting investment usually brings higher interest rates and higher bond yields. Today's higher market rates have arrived before faster growth. The sheer scale of data center investment, pegged at $1 trillion this year by Goldman Sachs, a bank, is making capital scarcer and helping raise yields. However, AI has yet to boost productivity measurably, even in China, where diffusion of the technology is arguably the furthest along. It could be a while before the boost comes. Electricity and computing took decades to raise productivity growth perceptively. Not all economies will fare equally well, either. Europe's fiscal woes could worsen if AI brings more growth for America, pulling up global interest rates, but gets jammed up in the old world by rigid labor markets and high energy costs. That could mean costlier debt without any growth. There is another problem, too. If the productivity boost from AI is large enough to transform any country's fiscal arithmetic, vast job disruption is probably coming, meaning more spending on unemployed workers. Income may also shift from labor to capital, which is more highly taxed. Should AI prompt an arms race, countries will also need more defense spending. Even the exciting prospect of longer lifespans fueled by AI-powered scientific advances will raise state spending on pensions. Economists at the Brookings Institution, a think tank, reckon these factors plus high interest rates could more than halve the positive impacts of AI-induced growth on American deficits. The last time much of the rich world, including America and Britain, ran budget surpluses was at the turn of the millennium. That required fast productivity growth, which came from computers and the early internet. But deficits had to be cut, too. Without fiscal prudence, bonds are a punt on AI that looks just as risky as betting on wobbly tech stocks. That was Onwards and Upwards. Governments are making a dangerous bet on the AI boom. So now we'll take a look at articles from around the world and begin with this one from Great Britain. Paddle power. Millions play paddle. Will anyone watch it? Britain is a test case. As Wimbledon's manicured lawns take a break after last month's tennis championships, London is playing host to a tournament for a newer racket sport. Paddle, a hybrid of tennis and squash, has backers who hope to take it to the big leagues. The London leg of the Premier Paddle, the Qatar-funded professional circuit on August 4th through 9th, is one of 26 elite tournaments in the calendar and the first to be held in Britain. Paddleistas from 15 countries, the leading players are Spanish and Argentine, are competing for a share of the €479,000 or $550,000 prize pot. It's the right moment for a tournament in London, said Luigi Carraro, the president of the International Paddle Foundation, the FIP. Paddle is one of the fastest growing sports in Britain. About 1 million people have played it at least once in the past year, according to the Lawn Tennis Association, the LTA, which governs paddle in Britain up from 15,000 only 6 years ago. The sight of brightly colored paddle courts encased in glass is increasingly familiar. In 2020, Britain had 87 of them. It now has over 2,000. Britain's boom is part of a global one. Paddle has 35 million players in 150 countries, according to the FIP. After starting in Mexico in 1969, the sport took off in Spain and Argentina before spreading across Europe and South America. Mr. Carraro wants it to become an Olympic sport, possibly for the 2032 Games in Brisbane. Why the boom? Paddle's underarm serve, forgiving rackets and small courts make it easy to learn. Money talks, too. Roughly three paddle courts can fit into the footprint of a single tennis court, creating more cash for clubs. The explosion in demand has meant Britain's courts are among the busiest and priciest in the world. The median fee of an indoor court is £44, or $59 per booking, though some in London can cost £100 an hour. But a sport that's fun to play is not necessarily fun to watch. Rob Mitchell, Premier Paddle's commercial director, dismisses such concerns. The 4,000 or so tickets for the final in London quickly sold out. The sport still has some catching up to do, however. Tennis had 5.6 million players in Britain at last count in 2023, and Wimbledon had total prize money of £64 million this year. The LTA is optimistic that the rise of paddle is complementing, not cannibalizing, tennis. But fashions change. Wimbledon itself began life as a croquet club. That was Paddle Power. Millions play paddle. Will anyone watch it? From the UK, we move to New Zealand with this article, No Country for Old Men. New Zealand's foreign minister sparks ire with a detestable taunt. But Winston Peters is not going anywhere. Go back to your own country, Winston Peters, New Zealand's foreign minister, shouted at Lawrence Zunan in Parliament on July 29th. That's where they lie like a flatfish, he went on at Mr. Zunan, who left China for New Zealand when he was a boy. The Green Party MP had angered Mr. Peters by asking in a debate about New Zealand's response to COVID if Mr. Peters had been vaccinated. Helen Clark, a former Labour Prime Minister whose government Mr. Peters also served as Foreign Minister in the 2000s, said that the remark would send a chill right around our migrant communities and questioned whether he could still manage relations with China, to which New Zealand sells a fifth of its exports. The Chinese embassy lodged a diplomatic protest. Mr. Peters first entered Parliament nearly five decades ago. Now 81 years old, he's the founder and to date the only leader of the populist New Zealand First Party. Since the late 1990s, he has drawn heavily on anti-Asian jibes, usually dressed up as anti-immigration rhetoric to keep his small party in Parliament. And he's done well out of that, positioning himself as a kingmaker in both centre-right and centre-left coalition governments, and serving as foreign minister three times, including in Jacinda Ardern's first government from 2017 to 2020. Christopher Luxon, the prime minister and leader of the centre-right National Party, has kept Mr. Peters as foreign minister despite telling reporters that he regarded his words as racist. The prime minister said Mr. Peters was speaking as the leader of New Zealand First rather than in his role as the country's foreign minister. But Mr. Luxon must be counting the days until October 1st when the parliament is due to be dissolved before a general election in November. At those polls, he's hoping to tout a still unratified free trade agreement with India as the centerpiece of his government's trade policy. Mr. Peters has loudly opposed the deal, calling it lopsided and objecting in particular to a provision that would allow a few thousand skilled migrants to enter New Zealand. That has forced Mr. Luxon to rely on Labour's support to pass an enabling bill. Mr. Peters cuts an unusual figure at the Beehive, as New Zealand's parliamentary complex is known, where the dress code is stubbornly business casual. Once considered a natty dresser, Mr. Peters still wears the boxy pinstriped and double-breasted suits topped off with a brocaded tie and a silk handkerchief that became his signature in the 1990s. Neither they nor his politics have changed since then. But while Mr. Peters looks like a throwback, his protectionist and anti-immigrant politics are now in fashion around the world. He will hope that gives him yet another chance to play kingmaker when November comes around. That was No Country for Old Men. New Zealand's foreign minister sparks ire with a detestable taunt. From Australasia, we move to the United States with this article, Call of Duty. America's income taxes are diverging. As states led by Democrats try to squeeze the rich, Republicans want to phase out income taxes entirely. When he was on the pro wrestling circuit, Glenn Jacobs, known as Kane in the ring, worked in nearly every state. The result was a tax return a foot tall. Now the Republican mayor of Knox County, Tennessee, Mr. Jacobs, is pleased that his state eliminated income taxes in 2021 and is serving as a model for other states. On August 4th, Missouri voted on a constitutional amendment to phase out income tax. It failed, but its presence on the ballot points to a broader trend. State tax systems are diverging. Much attention has been paid to Democrats' efforts to raise taxes on the rich. Washington State, for example, introduced an income tax on millionaires this year, and in November, Californians will vote on a wealth tax. But Republican-led states are moving in the other direction. Over the past 5 years, 26 states, most led by Republicans, have reduced their individual income taxes. Missouri's top marginal rate has fallen by more than 20% since 2017. This widening disparity is relatively new. Democrats and Republicans have always differed on taxes, but historically, states tried to stay within a range that raised revenue without dampening economic activity. It used to be possible to speak of a broad middle, with rates hovering around 6%, said Jarrett Walchak of the Tax Foundation, a think tank. Now you either have low rates, below 4%, or increasingly high-rate states entering into double digits, Mr. Walchak explains. Income taxes attract particular attention. Democrats preferred graduated income taxes to flat consumption taxes. The latter are regressive, imposing a disproportionate burden on low-income people who spend a greater share of what they earn. Republicans take a different view. Bishop Davidson, the Missouri state representative who sponsored the No Income Tax Amendment, argues that they are wildly invasive of people's privacy. In January, Donald Trump's Council of Economic Advisors published a report encouraging states to scrap income taxes and replace them with a broader, higher sales tax. It argued that taxing consumption rather than production is more economically efficient. But a tax model that works in one state may not in another. Florida has no income tax, but can collect sales tax from tourists. Texas also lacks an income tax, but fills its coffers with fees from oil and gas. In Missouri, income tax abolitionists consider Tennessee a more realistic approach. Mr. Davidson also studied South Carolina, where lawmakers voted in March to draw down income taxes, and North Carolina, a swing state, which will vote in November on a ballot measure to lower and cap its flat rate. Detractors dismiss such comparisons. It's apples and oranges, said Ashley Oon, a top Democrat in Missouri's House, not least because Tennessee has been only minimally reliant on income taxes for decades before abolishing it. Missouri, in contrast, depended on income tax for almost two-thirds of its revenue last year. Scott Charton, who advocated against abolishing the income tax, points out that Missourians rejected new taxes on services in 2016. The problem with eliminating one type of tax is that you probably have to raise another. In Missouri, that argument seemed to win out. That was Call of Duty. America's income taxes are diverging. And finally, this article from the UK. Grain drain. As the climate hurts Britain's wheat farmers, it's time to adapt. I can't remember ever finishing a harvest in July, said Mark Weeks, a farmer who grows 700 acres of winter wheat, barley, and oats in Exeter. Usually, Mr. Weeks cuts his crop about 3 weeks later, but hot, dry weather has ripened his grain faster and left it in a worse state. His fields have yielded a third less wheat and nearly two-fifths less barley than normal. A lot of it just shriveled, he said. The British crops have been bred to grow in a moderately wet and mild climate. This year's weather has been anything but. A very wet winter sapped nutrients from soils. A very dry summer sapped moisture. In July, Britain had just 10% of the typical rainfall for the month. The Environmental Agency declared half of England in drought. Across Britain, winter wheat has been cut early, its earliest harvest since 1976. Over half had been harvested by July 26, compared with just 11% a year earlier, according to the Agriculture and Horticultural Board. Wheat yields are down by nearly 16% on average, compared with the country's 10-year mean. In the east of England, where soils are light, farmers have reported yields down by half. Shoppers are unlikely to see shortages, though. About half of the wheat grown in Britain is used for animal feed. Much of the rest is milled for bread and biscuits. Britain already imports about 15% of its milling wheat, which can import more. The real cost will be borne by farmers. Last year's drought cost arable farmers over £800 million, that's $1.1 billion, in lost earnings. For example, nearly a quarter of the cereal sector's annual value, according to Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit. Our current situation is analogous to when British settlers landed in Australia in 1877 and saw their crops flounder in the heat, said Gail Taylor of the University College London. Wheat was then bred to withstand dry conditions. It's now Australia's most valuable crop. British farmers can adapt too. They can plant varieties more resilient to drought. And rather than relying on rain, they could use irrigation technology, as in California, typically deemed too costly. Until now. That was grain drain. As the climate hurts Britain's wheat farmers, it's time to adapt. Over the past hour, you've been listening to articles from the August 8th edition of the weekly magazine, The Economist. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell, and it's been my pleasure to read them. Thank you for listening. Tune in next week for another edition of The Economist, and stay tuned for more interesting programming right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.